This widespread optimism of the anti-systemic forces was nonetheless quite exaggerated for two reasons. One, the institutionalization of U.S. hegemony in the world system of 1945 made possible a generalized counter-revolutionary thrust. And my interjection, not to belabor the point too much, but the view from the ivory tower, and we must include among those who wear the ivory tower tag, the hierarchically structured left leadership of that day and beyond. Remember Lowe's documentation of how surviving Jews were thrown under the bus by just such. The view from the ivory tower is necessarily skewed. We down here in the cheap seats are able to see that the general, quote, generalized counter-revolutionary thrust had been stomping on us well before declared war removed millions of us from the planet. And I'm arguing, I think folks know that that's what they're calling the long 30 years war, and they encompass, they combine World War I and World War II, that they constituted a counter-revolutionary thrust well before the U.S. claimed world hegemony after that, after the field had been cleared. Continuing, one, the institutionalization of U.S. hegemony in the world system as of 1945 made possible a generalized counter-revolutionary thrust to slow down the pace of the growing political strength of the anti-systemic movements. The U.S. sought to contain the bloc of communist states led by the USSR. And in Greece, in Western Europe, in Korea, they succeeded in such containment. The U.S. government sought to defang the Western Labor and Social Democratic parties by rigidifying historic differences between the Second and Third Internationals and by erecting anti-communism as an ideological carapace shell. This attempt, too, was largely successful within the U.S. itself and elsewhere. The U.S. sought to slow down, dilute, and/or co-opt the political expressions of third world nationalism. And with some notable exceptions like Vietnam, this effort too was largely successful. Were the counter-revolution all that had occurred politically, however, its effect would have been momentary at most. And my interjection, by defining counter-revolution narrowly, i.e. to exclude totalitarianism with a left face, so distorts reality as to make it unrecognizable as such. Continuing, were the counter-revolution all that had occurred politically, however, its effect would have been momentary at most. A second thing occurred to dampen the optimism of the anti-systemic forces. The movements in power performed less well than had been expected, far less well. Already in the interwar period, the Soviet experience of the 1930s, the terrors and the errors, had shaken the world's anti-systemic movements. But in a sense, Hitler and the long struggle of the Second World War washed away much of the dismay. However, the terrors and the errors repeated themselves after 1945 in one communist state after another. Nor did the Social Democratic governments look that good, engaged as they were in colonial repression. And as one third world nationalist movement after another created regimes that seemed to have their own fair share of terrors and errors, the optimism of the anti-systemic forces began to be eroded. While the U.S. and more generally the upper strata of the world system, what I call power, the global state statesman, while the U.S. and more generally the upper strata attacked the anti-systemic movements exogenously, as it were, the movements were simultaneously suffering ailments endogenous to them. ailments which increasingly seem to be themselves part of the problem. It is in reaction to this double exogenous and endogenous difficulty of the traditional old left movements that the new social movements emerged, more or less in the 1960s. These new movements were concerned with the strength and survivability of the forces that dominated the world system. But they were also concerned with what they felt was the poor performance, even the negative performance, of the world's old left movements. In the beginning of the 1960s, the concern with the power and the evil of the proponents of the status quo was still uppermost in the minds of the emergent new movements. And their concern with the inefficacies of the old left opposition was still a secondary consideration. But as the decade wore on, the emphasis began to shift. As the new movements began to be more and more critical of the old movements. At first, the new elements sought to be reformist of the tactics of the old anti-systemic movements. Later, they often broke out right with them and even attacked them frontally. We cannot understand 1968 unless we see it as simultaneously a cri de coeur, a passionate appeal against the evils of the world system and a fundamental questioning of the strategy of the old left opposition to the world system. At its height, and when it had reached the highest level of screeching, the new left accused the old left of five sins: weakness, corruption, connivance, neglect, and arrogance. The weakness was said to be the inefficacy of the old anti-systemic movements, the social democrats in the West, the communists in the East, the nationalist governments in the South. The inefficacy of the old anti-systemic movements in constraining the militarism, the exploitation, the imperialism, the racism of the dominant forces in the world system. The attitude towards the war in Vietnam became a touchstone on this issue. The corruption was said to be the fact that certain strata had, through the efforts of past anti-systemic action, achieved certain material concessions and allowed their militants to be softened by this fact. The connivance was the charge of corruption taken one step further. It was said to be the willingness of certain strata worldwide actually to profit by the exploitation in the system, albeit at a lower level than that of the dominant strata. The neglect was said to be the obtuseness about, if not conscious ignoring of, the interests of the truly dispossessed, the real lower strata of the world system, the sub-proletarians, the ethnic and racial minorities, and of course, the women. The arrogance was said to be the contempt of the leadership of the old movements for the real problems of the lower strata and their ideological self-assurance. And my interjection, even a momentary plunge into the sterile waters of categorization following the vivid, and this was written right after the reading of, we did together of those chapters of Savage Continent, and so very much influenced by the horrors of those accounts he captures in that book. Savage Continent, Europe, in the aftermath of World War II. And it felt jarring to me, returning to the language of academe. And it highlights how far we've come these past almost 27 years toward a living, practical, actual, global unity of humanity, because we are more and more, I'm feeling, rejecting these empty categories that we're told to think in terms of, and recognizing that the strategy of power to impose this veneer of scientific rationality on our lived and living experience, in which we exchange mutually all the time, in which we reject categories all the time. We're moving, we're fluid, we're always changing and in motion. always. And academe, I believe, has been complicit in the process of trying to freeze us in place.